Waiters. 3 seconds left for three in the win. Yes! Deion has done it!
I watched Marcus Morris handling the ball like he was a point guard. I watched him give the ball to Julius Randle. This brother was dribbling the ball up the damn court.
First team all defense.
I don't know about this, but Rihanna just walked in front of me. Are you kidding me?
Welcome to the RotoWire NBA podcast. It is Tuesday, May 25th. We are presented by WynnBET. WynnBET is, of course, the presenting sponsor of the podcast throughout the NBA playoffs. Really glad to be partnering with WynnBET. Alex, we took last week off. I was on a brief sojourn to South Carolina, kind of hopefully, you know, timed it out well and was able to, you know, do it during a downtime, relatively at least. During the NBA season, and you know, was still able to keep up with what was going on in the play-in games, but got back just in time for the NBA playoffs. I did miss the end of the Bucks game, game one, on Saturday. My flight out of South Carolina literally took off 2 seconds after Jimmy Butler laid in the game-tying layup. So I was able to stream that. I'm like frantically sweating on the back of this plane, like sitting right behind the like engine or propeller or whatever it is, just like partially worried about whether or not like it's dangerous that the plane is this loud, and partially sweating out this Bucks game. So I did not know what happened in overtime. I knew the game went to overtime, and not until I landed back in Chicago a few hours later did I see that Chris Middleton hit the game-winning jumper with, you know, under a second left on the clock. But that's old news at this point. You know, the way that the NBA playoffs moves, obviously these games have such little shelf life as everything progresses night to night. We're recording this Tuesday evening, late afternoon into evening. So we won't go super deep on Lakers, Suns, Mavs, Clippers. And what's the third game tonight? I'm completely blanking. Celtics Nets. We won't go too deep on those. We're not going to turn back the clock and analyze game ones that happened a few days ago, or give you like 15 minutes to listen to this before those games start. But we'll catch up with those series later in the week. I do want to recap. I think we have to start with Milwaukee, Miami. Last night, which, you know, you and I put up an article over the weekend, kind of going back and forth on some of the bets that we liked. And one of mine was under 5.5 games for this series. And my thinking was that Milwaukee would be the team that would close it out. And they're on the way to doing that. We'll see. You know, very good chance Miami is able to take at least one as the series shifts now to South Beach. But man, I like the way Milwaukee was able to pull out game one. It certainly felt like had they lost game one, the series could very easily turn the way that it did a year ago. But, you know, the way that they were able to come out in game two and basically put that away within 6 minutes of game time and never really look back was extremely impressive.
It was. I mean, you know, as a Bucks fan or someone who, you know, is a Bucks optimist, like you, after such a bad 3-point shooting performance in game one and still being able to win that game, the assumption was like, even if Jimmy Butler has a better game, you know, if the Bucks shoot better from three, it just should be a win, you know, kind of based on what we saw in game one. And both of those kind of went to the extremes. Like Jimmy Butler had another, you know, just like down performance. He was 4-for-10. Bucks go 22-of-53 from beyond the arc. And it gets out of hand quickly. I think the Bucks scored like 78 in the first half. I mean, I wasn't expecting this. You know, I'm someone who, you mentioned the bet earlier, you know, over under 5.5 games for the series. I would have bet the over if you made me, just because I thought, given the history of these teams, you know, it was hard for me to imagine a 5-game series. But now I think the Bucks really have the Heat on their heels here, especially since the Heat just can't get going at all offensively right through these first two games. Adebayo, Jimmy Butler, they're both under, I think, 35% shooting. They just like, and when those guys aren't able to get their points, it's like, as much as Goran Dragic is fine, you know, it's like Tyler Hero is not playing up to his standards from last year. Duncan Robinson got hot from three in the first game, but how many times is he going to do that exactly again? I think the Bucks, this is firmly in the Bucks' grasp right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought Adebayo last night had some like Draymond Green moments on offense where he's just throwing the ball up and hoping that it bounces around and goes in. Like he has no confidence offensively. He doesn't look quite as physically dominant, I thought, as he did for most of the playoffs last year. You know, he looks more like the Bam that was kind of hobbled in the finals, I thought, where, you know, he's still a great player and still one of the two or three best options Miami has, but he's just not really asserting himself, I think, in the way that Miami obviously needs him to crawl back into this series. You know, he's not blocking shots. He hasn't been the same guy on the defensive end. I did think he did a really good job overall on Giannis in game one, making him uncomfortable, forcing him into, you know, a lot of kind of contested fadeaways, getting him to the line where he I think barely eclipsed 50% in game one. He was better there in game two. But yeah, this was just an absolute blitzing. And, you know, normally when a team has a crazy first quarter where I think the Bucks had 10 threes, right, in the first quarter.
Yeah.
I think that's right. You know, normally, like, at some point the team makes a run and all of a sudden it's down to 14 or it's down to 12 and, you know, you're starting to call timeouts and you're getting a little nervous. Like, that never happened in this game at all. And part of it was because they built a 26-point lead at the end of the first quarter. That's a tough lead to blow. But, like, at no point did Miami, outside of Dwayne Dedmon, I should say, he's exempt from all criticism. This was a fantastic effort from Dwayne Dedmon off the bench. But outside of that, like, there was not a single time where Miami even threatened to make this a game.
No, and it's like, you know, they're doing a good job on Giannis too. Like you mentioned, Giannis is only 44% from the field, but they can't keep him off the offensive glass.
Yep.
He's got 12 offensive rebounds in this series. You know, the Bucks they're getting a little more comfortable kind of playing Giannis like a big man, like they've done throughout, you know, a lot of the year so far, and it's really paying off, I think, right now. And even like Jrue Holiday is 1-for-9 on threes. Brooke Lopez is 1-for-7 on threes. Those guys haven't recovered from their struggles in game one from beyond the arc. And you figure like those guys are bound to, you know, get back on track.
Right. Giannis himself is 1-of-10 from three.
Right. Yeah. And you can maybe say the same thing. Like Heat fans will say the same thing. Well, Jimmy Butler is not going to keep shooting 25% from the field. You know, he's going to shoot better than the 64% from the free throw line he's been doing. But I mean, both, you know, Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo and Kendrick Nunn, who are the top four field goal attempt guys on the team right now, are all under 35% from the field. And that is rough. Hero is at 20%. And I understand those are bound to bounce back in some way, but you don't get those low of numbers in the NBA just through like two games of just poor shooting on like open jumpers. That's like game plan. They're stymieing you.
Yeah, I mean, with Butler in game one, it's like, if you want to write that off, that's fine. I mean, he took 22 shots. He obviously didn't have it in that game, and that was that. And in some ways, you know, it's hard to pick apart a box score of a game that was completely over by the end of the first quarter. Like, you don't want to read too much into it. But at the same time, I mean, the window's closing here. Like, you know, Jimmy Butler, if he's going to bounce back, it has to be in game three. And, you know, if Miami's down 0-3 after that, it's pretty much over. You know, I think the Bucks have done a pretty remarkable job of getting the bench going, especially in game two. You know, we mentioned all the poor shooting for Giannis, for Lopez, for Holiday, for even DiVincenzo, who's been low-key really bad in these first two games. You can't expect to get 11 three-pointers out of Pat Connaughton and Brim Forbes, especially on 18 attempts on a nightly basis. But if those guys are giving you five or six makes, and you know, guys like Holiday and Lopez and perhaps Giannis are, you know, progressing toward the mean, like the Bucks shooting performance overall wasn't overly remarkable. You know, they're 22 of 53 from 3-point range. That's 41%. That's not going to happen every single night, but this is a team that takes a bunch of threes, has a lot of guys who are comfortable shooting threes. Like it's not crazy that they could make, you know, 15 to 18 threes the rest of the series with the way that some of these guys I think are due.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, Forbes is someone who like practically shoots every time he touches it, right? I mean, that's kind of like he's when he's hot, he's great. When he's cold, you just take him out. And yeah, you mentioned DiVincenzo, who, I mean, I felt like last year he was kind of getting exposed in the playoffs too. This year, again, it feels like he's not doing that great. That's something, you know, I mean, long-term, the Bucks might have to figure out. I mean, you know, they tried to trade him, right? I mean, that's not exactly a secret. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, Heat very much backed into a wall. Like the only two players who have not had issues so far are Goran Dragic and Duncan Robinson.
Yeah.
Other than that, the rest of the team is really in a tough way.
And Dwayne Dedmon. Can't forget Dwayne Dedmon. I was watching the game last night with my girlfriend, And she posted actually an interesting question that I at the time was like, I need to remember this for tomorrow. She was like, I thought the Heat were really good. How did they get so bad? And I think that's a good jumping off point to ask, was last year, you know, assuming that Miami doesn't jump back into the series and all of a sudden, you know, it's Heat in six, you know, if this keeps going the way it goes, was last year an aberration? Was this year just a weird year with the bubble and, you know, a team that never fully coalesced? Like, it felt like kind of half the league was in that spot. Like, how do we judge this Heat team versus what it was able to accomplish last year?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, you kind of see the memes going around on Twitter about, like, you know, the Heat being bubble frauds or something of that extent, right? Mm-hmm. And it could go down that way. I mean, I think we, you know, there's been some evidence that, you know, shooting was way up in the, I mean, shooting was up in the bubble, just percentage, efficiency, the whole thing. We saw, like, that whole, even you can almost just take the entire series between the Jazz and the Nuggets, between the Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray performances, as like one series to encapsulate how insane the offense was in the bubble last year. And I think to some extent, like, the Heat may have benefited from that. And I don't think nothing really changed that much, right? I mean, they lost Jay Crowder. That's the thing people are saying, like, it caused them to struggle the most. And that's not that big of a deal. Like, Jay Crowder's good, but it's not the difference between, like, NBA Finals and this.
He was 0-7 from 3 in Game 1 against the Lakers, for what it's worth.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, he does other things, too. He's a decent rebounder. He's a good defender. But, yeah, I think, in general, I think they may have really benefited from the bubble. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, they're in a more natural environment, and they just aren't the team. They aren't a conference finals team.
I also think making the finals boosted their profile and kind of made everyone forget that they were the number 5 seed in the East last year going into the playoffs. Like, I think they were like one game above the 6th seed. Like, they were not, you know, it's not like they were this dominant team for all of last year, really, until they broke through against Milwaukee in round 2. Like, I don't think a lot of people took the Heat as like a serious title contender. I think everyone expected Milwaukee, maybe not to roll over Miami, but certainly to win that series and keep progressing. And as soon as Miami won that, it kind of flipped the entire narrative, I think, on their season. So, like, comparing them in the regular season last year to Miami in the regular season this year, not all that different. You know, the win percentage is a little bit lower, like 2 or 3 games difference this year. But, you know, with all the COVID stuff and the injuries and the way the schedule was put together, I don't know that that's like a perfect 1-to-1 comparison. But I think this team is pretty much the same team in the regular season this year that it was last year. And like you said, the one thing that's different was the bubble situation a year ago. Now you're back in a, you know, more normal, quote unquote, setting, even if you only have 50% fans in a lot of these arenas. So we'll see. I mean, as it shifts to Miami, you know, I don't know how much of a difference playing in front of a crowd actually makes. I've been pretty impressed, I think, with how palpable the crowds have been, how much they've come through on TV, despite the capacity restrictions. Like, for the most part, I think it sounds like a full capacity crowd. I don't, maybe they're playing with the dials on the audio, but at the same time, that's also not going to account for a 34-point beatdown in game 2. You can't blame the crowd for that.
No, and I mean, some of it too could just be, everybody talks about, you know, the Lakers, you know, they only got 70 days off between the seasons, the 2 seasons or whatever. I feel like that discourse is not happening with the Heat for some reason. Do you also get that vibe? Like, everyone's talking about, well, the Lakers are exhausted, you know, oh, they did it. But with the Heat, everyone's like, they're kind of just underperforming. And I feel like it doesn't get brought up that they, you know, the Lakers were playing somebody in the NBA Finals and they played the same amount of games.
No, that is true. Like, somehow because they lost the finals, it feels like they like didn't play as many games or something. Right. No, you're totally right. Like, that does get brought up in the Lakers context. And maybe it's because the Lakers have had some higher profile, longer term injuries, you know, where you can, if people are kind of scratching for a reason for why this happened, you know, it's pretty easy to say, well, LeBron, you know, wouldn't have tweaked his ankle if it wasn't for the bubble, or this wouldn't have happened to Anthony Davis if they weren't playing in the finals. Whereas, you know, Miami's had guys in and out, but they haven't, you know, they haven't been these longer pronounced injuries like the Lakers have had.
Right. Yeah. And they kind of just missed some guys at the beginning. Like, they got hit with the coronavirus stuff. So.
What's up, guys? Are you looking for a new contest to play during the 2021 NBA playoffs? If so, try Fantasy 5's new free-to-play NBA contest. It's simple.
All you have to do is pick one player to beat their fantasy point target from each of the five games. If all your picks are correct, you can win a share of the $5,000 jackpot. Other guaranteed prizes are also available if you finish atop the weekly leaderboard, including an official NBA kit. Make the NBA postseason more interesting. Go to fantasy5.com today. That's fantasy5.com to enter your picks today.
Blazers Nuggets, game two of that series last night, you know, kind of an inverse of what we saw in game one, which was close throughout. You know, Denver even controlled it at times, and then Portland turned it on in the third quarter and never really looked back in that game. And this one was kind of back and forth early on as well. And this time it was Denver that jumped out more so in the second quarter than the third, and was able to just continue piling up points in the second half and get to 128. They held Portland to 109 in this game. Denver put up 42 in the second quarter. Damian Lillard got his. It seemed like they were semi okay with that. He had 42 and 10 in game two, but CJ McCollum, an efficient night, had 21 points, but only took 12 shots. I think if you're Denver, you're really happy with that number. Only got to the line two times. Denver took 13 more field goals than Portland in this game, and the Blazers turned it over 21 times. And honestly, that was, 21 seems high. I mean, watching the game, I feel like it didn't quite seem like they had that many. Defensively, this was a really impressive performance from Denver, which I felt like the Nuggets got kind of punched in the mouth in game one. And I had no idea without Jamal Murray, no idea how this game two was going to go. And all of a sudden now we're back to even, heading to Portland for game three.
Yeah, I took the Trailblazers in our handicapping the NBA article for our picks. Partially, I just think they're going to still win the series. So I was fine betting on them to win game two. But yeah, I mean, the turnovers, when you turn the ball over not nearly twice as much, but 21 to 13 turnover, differential, that's pretty rough. Like there's not a ton you can do. You have to, you really do have to kind of catch fire offensively to make up for that. Because the rebounding was pretty similar aside from that. Yeah. I think we have to credit, Michael Malone for kind of countering with a game plan here, because we, very much understood what Portland was trying to do and just not let Jokic pass. And he still only, I think, had five assists in this game. But he was able to score a ton. And yeah, I still think Portland's talent's too overwhelming in the long run. But this was a really great game for Denver to have, at least just from a confidence standpoint. Because if they were to get hit again, in the same way they did in game one, especially if Jokic was limited passing again, I think that would have been pretty rough for them.
Right. I mean, Denver, without having Jamal Murray, I don't know if either of these teams, like, this is the series I think I just have no clue what's going to happen. And I think Atlanta, New York, which we'll touch on in the East, is kind of the same way. Game to game, I feel like my opinion of how things are going to go is just going to swing wildly. But yeah, I don't know that either of these teams have what it takes to come back if they were to fall down 0-2 or fall down 3-1 later on in the series. Like I think this is going to be one where it could easily just go every other, and then kind of toss it up for game seven, and whichever team's able to pull it out is going to advance. But I don't know. It's just really tough to get a read on the series. I think Portland is the more complete team right now because there's no Jamal Murray for Denver, but at the same time, we saw Jusuf Nurkić was in foul trouble this entire game, only played 25 minutes, fouled out early in the fourth quarter. And at that point, the game was definitely heading toward a Denver victory, but that sealed it. At that point, it was Jokic was able to get whatever he wanted against Enes Kanter. So you have an already like fairly shaky starting center in Jusuf Nurkić. And once he fouls out, you're bringing in like one of the notoriously worst defending centers of the last two decades. And beyond that, you have no other options. Like they don't just have like a Dwayne Dedman that you can throw out there and just be a body and go get some rebounds and block some shots and pick up some fouls. Like I think if that's kind of the one kryptonite maybe for Portland is, you have some bodies, I guess, that you could throw at Jokic, but neither of those guys are really equipped to handle an MVP caliber center who can beat you inside and out.
All right, Portland could have really benefited from having Marc Gasol. Yes. I think that would help.
Just a third guy in general, yeah.
Yeah, third right guy. Now. Yeah, right, exactly. Because you mentioned it. I mean, Nurkic, Nurkic is very important for this series. Him basically not getting in foul trouble. He doesn't even have to play that well offensively because they've gotten this far without him playing that well offensively all season. He just needs to rebound and he needs to just stop Jokic from, you know, from playing bully ball essentially. But yeah, when he fouls out, I mean, it's curtains to some extent because, I mean, you know, Kanter certainly can't guard Jokic straight up and you can't double Jokic. You know, everyone knows that.
Yeah. Portland was minus 14 in Kanter's 18 minutes and they play the Nuggets even in Nurkic's 25. And I mean, that's a one game sample. I don't think it's always going to be that way. You know, certainly Jokic is capable of exploiting Nurkic as well. But I mean, I think Lillard at this point is just going to get his no matter what. I don't really think it matters who's around him, who's fouled out, you know, who's at center. McCollum, for the most part, is the same way. I think this was somewhat of a down game for him. He had 5 of the 21 turnovers, very uncharacteristic. But that really is going to be the swing position for Portland. I think you kind of know what you're getting with Norman Powell. At this point, you know what you're getting with Robert Covington. I think we're beyond the days of expecting anything more than like 7 points and maybe a couple threes from Covington. Like, he's kind of all defense at this point. You know, it's going to come down to Nurkic. And if he's fouling out early in the fourth quarter and scoring 7 points on 2 of 8 shooting, you're probably going to lose that game 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, the Nuggets, I mean, they're guarding CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard with Austin Rivers and Campazzo. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, you expect Lillard and McCollum to combine for like 60 points every game. Yeah. It's just kind of a matter of, you know, the other guys at least chipping in. Mm-hmm. I don't expect Powell had a decent game, but I don't really expect Melo 1 for 5. That's pretty rough. He's not going to do that every game. Right. He'll have a better game than that. But yeah, Lillard and McCollum aren't going to have any issues in this series.
Yeah. I mean, you look at Portland's 3-point shooting in game 2, it's 16 of 33. 48.5% as a team. You know, they shot 48% from the field. You feel pretty good about those, but then you look at it, it's like, okay, Lillard and McCollum are accounting for virtually all of that production. I mean, they had 11 of the 16 threes. They both shot efficiently from the floor overall. You know, like I said, I think the Blazers are the more complete team, but at the same time, much like Denver at this point with some of the attrition that they have, like, the Portland bench drops off pretty quickly. I think I like their top six, and that yeah. Sixth guy has kind of rotated for now. It's Melo, you know, slash Kanter. But beyond that, it's like, you know, Anthony Simons played really well in game 1, didn't give them anything in game 2. And, you know, Derrick Jones Jr. was starting for a lot of this year. He's out of the rotation. Nas Little, kind of the same thing. Rondae Hollis Jefferson had his moment early on. Like, they probably need at least one of those guys, you know, Simons being the most likely, you know, to really step up. And if Simons can go like 3 of 7 from 3 in 19 minutes off the bench, like, that's huge for them.
I agree. Yeah, they definitely need like a seventh guy. Cause I mean, they're obviously committed to Carmelo as a sixth guy, and I don't hate that. It's less than ideal. It's more, mm-hmm. He's more of a name at this point, but yeah, Simons would be huge for them. Even Derrick Jones, you know, like yeah. You mentioned.
I think they're contractually obligated by Jordan Brand to play Melo 20 plus minutes every single game.
Yeah, I think so.
Which
too.
This whole situation has worked out so much better than I ever thought it would. When, like, it feels like he's been with the Blazers for 5 years at this point. Like, it's crazy to think that. I think at the time that he signed, I was like, oh, he's going to sign like a non-guaranteed deal and be out of there in 3 weeks. And it's actually worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I mean, it's a lot. Melo's end of career arc is a lot smoother now than there. There were a lot of other scenarios where it was much less smooth than this.
Well, I mean, Houston and OKC, Melo, I think they might just wipe that from the historical record.
Yeah, I mean, that really felt like the end. Like, there were some desperate moments in there. I mean, he was, you know, another season. He was another season away from, like, begging for jobs on Twitter.
I hate to admit this, but I know, like, 5 or 10 years from now, I'm going to purchase a Carmelo Anthony Thunder jersey. It's going to happen. It's like the idea has just, like, been in my brain, and, like, there's really nothing I can do about it.
Is it going to be one of those, that, like, weird blue Thunder alternate with, like, the white stripe on the side? I don't even know if they, like, use those.
Is it, like,
the
vertical lettering?
Yeah, the vertical.
Yeah, I always try to be careful. Like, if I'm going to buy a jersey, and, like, I know it's, like, embarrassing that I'm still even, like, thinking about buying jerseys at this age. But I think of it as, like, a collection at this point. It's not like yeah. I'm wearing these all over the place. But it has to be one that the player actually wore, right? Like, I wouldn't buy a, I don't know, like a LeBron James Miami Vice jersey because he never wore it.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to make that clear because a lot of people who I've seen out in the wild wearing jerseys don't seem to understand that, and it's just something that, you know, us in the jersey community, we need to kind of be gatekeepers.
You need to start a dialogue about that for sure.
So I think we're heading toward a Bucks Nets collision course here in round two, and you know, we'll see. Milwaukee Miami is far from over. I don't want to call curtains on that one by any means. I'm 100% sure that the Nets are going to beat the Celtics. It did feel to me that I didn't really think that the Celtics had any chance to steal a game in the series. But looking back, you know, the fact that they held Brooklyn to 16 points in the first quarter in game one, they led that game by 6 at the half. And ultimately, the Nets turned on the Jets in the second half and were just fine. But I think that was probably going to be Boston's best chance to get one, you know, unless the Nets just no-show one of these games in Boston coming up. But either way, I think we're heading towards Bucks Nets in round two. And I want to ask you, if you were to handicap that prospective series right now, assuming everybody's healthy, you know, both teams, you know, move smoothly through the rest of round one, what do you think would be the most likely series outcome? So you can give me your answer, like what you think will happen, or, you know, if you were at the, you know, the WynnBET sportsbook, you know, what odds you would throw out there for the most likely outcome, like which team, how many games?
So I think it'll be between Nets and 6 and Nets and 7.
Okay, that's exactly what I wrote down too. I think you're right.
And I think a lot of that is going to just depend on how dominant the Bucks and Nets look in the next to end the current series.
Sure.
Like if the Nets, because I think if the Bucks sweep Miami, and it's embarrassing for Miami, and if the Nets win in 5. Like they just drop one against the Celtics, I think it becomes Nets in 6. But I think if the Bucks drop one and the Nets sweep, then it's Nets in 7. Like I think it's pretty dependent on who looks dominant and who ends up dropping one of these games between the two. Personally, I think regardless of outcome of these two series that are going on right now, I think it should be Nets in 6. I still believe in the Nets talent being way too overwhelming.
And
even though the Bucks are better, it would be hard for me to say this is the 7-game series.
Right. So I think we're on the same page. For me, in order of likelihood, I think it would be Nets in 6, Nets in 7, Bucks in 7, but Bucks in 6. Yeah. I think that's probably right. I would be tempted personally to throw Nets in 5 in there. I think I'd go Nets in 6, Nets in 7, Bucks in 7, Nets in 5. Like I don't think there's a chance Milwaukee wins that series in 5, but I do think there's a chance that if the Nets arrive like really locked in, and you know Kevin Durant looks like at the last time we saw him at his peak, which was what, the 2019 finals or even the 2018 finals, you know, like when he was, you know, at the absolute peak of his game with great players around him, he's an unbelievably hard player to beat. And when those other two players are Kyrie Irving and James Harden, even a team like the Bucks that I think actually matches up fairly well against a team that has 3 future Hall of Famers about as well as you can. You know, we'll see how much time Giannis spends on Durant. Obviously, Drew Holiday is pretty comfortable guarding either Kyrie or James Harden. And, you know, you have Middleton, you have Tucker. Like, I kind of like on paper the matchups that Milwaukee could throw out there. But the problem is all 3 of those guys are virtually matchup proof at some point when it comes to getting their shots off. Like, there's, you know, you could be Drew Holiday, who every player in the league says, you know, like, I hate when this guy guards me. But to me, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden James Harden's going to average 15 points a game in that series.
Right. And yeah, it's, you know, we've seen Giannis do a decent job on Durant when switched onto him. I mean, he blocked his jump shot in that last Bucks.
That was a shocking moment. Game. I've never seen Durant get blocked like that.
It was a shocking moment. But again, I'm not sure how much time Giannis will actually spend on him. I mean, I'm kind of interested in how much, you know, Giannis at center the Bucks go to. I mean, he averaged like 40 points in those last, that 2-game series against the Nets.
Yeah.
And he was taking like 30 shots a game. And he was just like, first game, he abused DeAndre Jordan. Second game, he abused Blake Griffin. And so, yeah, I'm kind of interested. I mean, maybe they'll go Brooke Lopez in the post more. I agree with you that there are some interesting, you know, aspects of it. And I think the PJ Tucker acquisition was for this series. Mm-hmm. It feels like.
Yeah, I think this series or a potential Philly series. I think at the time, you know, either of those matchups were well in play. I mean, if you're the Bucks, how do you attack that series? Like, would you use Giannis more on the block? Are you trying to get him in a a one-on-one situation where he has Brooke Lopez or Jeff Green on his back instead of Giannis, you know, trying to attack a Kevin Durant 25 feet from the basket. Because my main concern is if you're going to put him on Durant for, let's say, 75% of the time that he's out there, I think you have to expect that he's picking up a few fouls. And at that point, like if I'm Bud, I'm very worried about, you know, how many offensive fouls is Giannis going to pick up? He's gotten better at that over the years. But I think the Nets know that they don't really have a matchup for Giannis inside. And I think the strategy might be like, look, if you have nothing to do here, either wrap him up and put him at the free throw line or go down and hope that they call something and we get four fouls on this guy early in the third quarter.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the Bucks, the game plan should just be to just hammer the Nets inside. And yeah, with Giannis, that would be like a lot of Giannis, you know, basically like maybe you can get James Harden in the action, you know, whoever's guarding James Harden runs the pick and roll, Giannis rolls to the basket, get Giannis on the block, get him in his face-up game, kind of like he was doing against Blake, and just do that. And even like Jrue Holiday can get inside. I mean, Holiday is incredible once he gets into the paint. He can, right. he plays like a big almost when he gets in there. Yeah, so I think that would have to be the game plan because you're not going to outshoot them. You know, Giannis coming downhill, I think they would still put the wall up. The more Giannis goes downhill, it's almost like the less I like it. Because you mentioned the offensive fouls. For him, those are too much. They're too easy to call when he has a full head of steam. You know,
right. And he draws it. He gets a ton of charges called on him. I almost feel like more like 80% of the time it's legit. Like there's a lot of them that are kind of 50-50 when you watch basketball around the league. But like being as big as he is and taking as long of strides as he does, like more often than not, I feel like it's the right call. He's just a little bit out of control.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. And so that's a much harder call to make when someone like faces up and doesn't have a full head of steam. And there's a lot more just like shoulder to shoulder, just kind of banging. So, yeah, that would be the game plan, I think.
If I'm Milwaukee, too, I think, you know, it's enough of a burden to try to slow down, especially Harden and Kyrie with the backcourt on the offensive end. But I think you have to make those guys play defense, too. And, you know, that means not settling for a ton of threes, you know, not just pulling up in transition, not, you know, calling for one screen and just, you know, taking a long two, which, you know, Chris Middleton is one of the best in the league at that. I'm not saying you can't take any of those, but, you know, running those guys through actions, like having Bryn Forbes come in for 4 minutes at a time and just run baseline to baseline or get ahead in transition and like force Kyrie Irving, especially, I think, to care on the defensive end and expend energy on that end, because if those guys are able to, you know, spend 95% of their energy on the offensive end, I don't think there's a way that Milwaukee could win that series. I think the amount of top end talent for the Nets is just too overwhelming.
Right. I expect them to switch the Nets, but then you have to punish them for switching, you know. And the Bucks actually have the personnel to do that between Giannis, Holiday, who I mentioned can play bully ball, Chris Middleton can back guys in and shoot like 12 footers that go in every single time. Brooke Lopez, you know, obviously like I think he's worse in the post than people realize, but if he's got someone who's like, you know, if he gets Kyrie on him, he'll make that. I think part of the issue here for the Bucks is, I like we mentioned at the top, I think PJ Tucker plays an important role in this series because I'm a little worried. I don't think you can play like the Brooke Lopez drop coverage against this team much because they're just going to fire from three every single time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a pretty even minute split between Tucker and Lopez, right? I mean, I think there are some advantages to Lopez, but especially if he's not shooting the ball really well, those advantages dwindle pretty quickly. And, you know, and the Nets also probably aren't going to be playing a traditional center for him to match up with for most of this game. And, you know, he can guard Blake Griffin. He can guard Jeff Green. You know, Nick Claxton's been kind of in and out. He's at least taken a lot of the DeAndre Jordan minutes, but you know, ideally you're matching Brooke Lopez up with a DeAndre Jordan type. And I think having Tucker as an option is going to be huge. I would be pretty surprised if both teams and especially Milwaukee don't really tighten up the rotations for this series. Yeah. I think if you're the Bucks, you probably want to be playing. I mean, knowing Bud, they're probably going to play eight or nine guys, but I mean, I think you want six or seven guys playing the vast majority of your minutes, maybe even six.
Yeah, I mean, if you're Milwaukee, you have to consider taking out the Kong at 10 minutes.
Yep.
I think you have to consider taking out. I think you put Brent Forbes in no matter what, because he can just swing a game when he's hot from three.
I think you're alternating Forbes and DiVincenzo, and I think you're probably slashing DiVincenzo's minutes a little bit.
Yeah, and I think Portis deserved to get in there. I mean, there are a lot of games, in my opinion, where Portis plays better than Lopez. So you have to be ready for that possibility too. Of just like if Portis is playing better than Lopez, you just got to put him in there.
He's also a significantly better 3-point shooter than Lopez at this point. Yes. Yeah, I think Lopez has a reputation. Like, I mean, Bobby Portis was one of the most efficient 3-point shooters in the league this season, and Lopez still jacks up a ton of threes, but I mean, he really has not hit them at the same rate. Like two seasons ago, 2018-19 was his like Draymond year, where it was like 37%, he's hitting everything. And then, you know, it's been 31 and 33 the last 2 years, which it's still nice to have a big man who is a threat from three, but it's now gotten to the point where like that's all he does, and he's just not shooting it at the level that his reputation would imply.
As a Bucks fan, I've become less and less impressed with Lopez over the past 2 years. I think he has, yeah. I mean, and Portis too. I mean, Portis, this isn't like out of nowhere for him. He's 38% for his career on threes. You know, he's not like a volume guy, but he did 36% last year. So, you know, I think there's going to be some, you know, like I feel like they'll want to play Lopez at least 20 minutes just because he's just organizationally. I don't know how it would go over if you play Brooke Lopez like 14 minutes a game in a series, but I don't think we should be surprised if Portis is out there a lot more than like the casual fan would expect.
All right. Do you have anything to say about the Philly Washington series? If not, we'll move on. I have very few thoughts about this one.
I think Washington, that game one, that was their chance.
Yeah.
I think that was it.
That felt a lot like Boston-Brooklyn game one, yep, where I didn't really give Washington a chance, but all of a sudden, like halfway through the game, you're like, I guess they could pull this out.
Yeah, I think Philly and Brooklyn were both just like, how little can we try and still win this game? Yeah. And you kind of experiment with that, and I think it was a success. So I think the series is pretty much over.
Yep, I feel the same way. I think Washington's more likely to steal a game from Philly to me than Boston is from Brooklyn, but I think both of those will be over pretty quickly. Let's go to Memphis and Utah. Awesome game one. Obviously no Donovan Mitchell. That was kind of the pall hanging over that entire game, and that story has just kind of gotten stranger and stranger as we've gotten more details. But he will be back for game two. That obviously changes things a ton for Utah. That's a huge boost. You're getting your best player, by far your best offensive player, back. At the same time, there were some concerns, I think, in game one that, and like, for as great as Donovan Mitchell is, like, he's not LeBron or Durant or Harden or Steph Curry, where, you know, the team just like falls apart when that guy's not there, because you're usually the team is so dependent on that one guy, and obviously they struggled without him, but, you know, throughout the regular season, you know, they were able to sustain pretty well without Donovan Mitchell. And, you know, there's still some debate as to, like, you know, who is truly the more valuable player between him and Rudy Gobert. And then all of a sudden you remove Donovan Mitchell, and this was a disastrous game one for Utah. I mean, the final score was only a 3-point spread, but I mean, Memphis came out and outscored Utah by 13 in the second quarter, you know, kept pouring it on in the third. And it was just really kind of strange, I guess, to see Memphis control this entire game pretty much from start to finish, or at least for the last three quarters.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it, although I was expecting Donovan Mitchell to play. And I do kind of wonder how much of a distraction that was for Utah, because by all accounts, it was like he was going to play, and then he didn't. So that was...
Were you watching the TNT pregame show by chance?
I was not. I did not.
It was like a mini... Like, Ernie Johnson was like insisting that he was playing, and then Charles Barkley was like, I don't think he is. And then they both were like, wait a second, like, did I get bad information? It was just like a super awkward TV moment that you never see. But that speaks to how weird this was. Like, Ernie Johnson is insisting on live TV, no, Donovan Mitchell is playing. And, you know, those who are, apparently Ernie had not been on Twitter in the last hour, because that's where it broke. I don't really want to get into Donovan Mitchell versus the Jazz medical staff, because you and I have no information on that. That's not already out there. Strange situation, no matter what. But I mean, the Jazz are in a hole, and they can certainly climb out of it. I think most people would expect them to climb out of it, but I don't know. I just feel like they looked worse than they should have
for not having Donovan Mitchell. Even if everybody expected to have him until an hour or two before game time, I still feel like this team, you know, it's just kind of one of those classic like regular season teams where you plug and play guys and it doesn't seem to matter who's out there. A lot like the Bucks the last couple of years, where even if Giannis would miss a game, the show would go on and they'd still be blowing out teams night to night. I kind of expected that to still be the case for Utah, and then they just looked a little more rattled than I thought they would.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think, I mean, some of this too comes down to Memphis, again, continues to do a good job of limiting turnovers and doing great on the offensive glass. Like, they won both categories,
yeah,
which isn't necessarily something you would expect against the Jazz, right? Like, the Jazz have Gobert, and we talk about how great they are as a team all the time in terms of, you know, the great playmaking, the lack of mistakes, but they just got beat on both of those parts of the floor. Mm-hmm. And when that happens and they're cold from three, they're just not the recipe to win a game when you lose those three categories. Yeah. It's nearly impossible.
Well, Gobert also fouled out of this game too.
Well, and he did.
And that's noteworthy for defensive purposes. But, you know, at that point, it obviously was a loss for Utah, but it's not like you're sitting there like, oh man, how are they going to crawl back into this game? They don't have Gobert to score. You know, like obviously they could have used him late in the game when Memphis was able to get bucket after bucket and close it out. But it was just such a strange game one. And I think Memphis also deserves a lot of credit for the way that they've closed not only this game, but against Golden State as well. And a lot of the games down the stretch that have mattered for them, like, I mean, Utah was able to climb back into this game late. You know, Bogdanovich was hitting a ton of shots. And every time you would think, like, okay, this young Memphis team is going to cave. You know, they're going to commit a turnover. They're going to take a bad shot. Like, it just never happened. They just keep getting good shots. They keep making smart plays. You know, I don't know if they're just, like, a little bit underrated or, you know, people just haven't watched a lot of the Grizzlies this year. But it didn't really feel like the Jazz just, like, threw this game away. Like, I felt like Memphis kind of took it from them.
Yeah, I mean, I've continued to be really impressed with the Grizzlies. I mean, I've watched their, you know, from the regular season, the last regular season game on, I've watched their games. And despite not being like a great 3-point shoot, like they're one of the teams who just like, they know exactly who they are, right? It feels like every single player on their team knows their role. Morant continues to like be insanely impressive given his like lack of a 3-pointer. You know, just his quickness, his ability to hit those floaters. Valanciunas is still like unbelievable in the role that he plays. Dylan Brooks has taken a complete step forward. Like he is kind of the definition of like a playoff player, right? Like in the regular season, like he obviously plays good defense and he does take some ill-advised shots and you look at the advanced numbers and you're like, is Dylan Brooks even that good? But then when you see him turn it on 100%, you're like, oh, like, you know why, like, you quickly understand why the Grizzlies give him the minutes that they do. Like, he is so integral to what they do on a game-to-game basis. It's crazy.
Yeah, the rise of Dylan Brooks is one of the more improbable scenarios. I never would have saw this coming. Like, James and I have made fun of Dylan Brooks so many times on the pod when we were discussing him as a prospect because he was just such a gunner at the college level. He showed up to the combine. Like, I remember his arms were, like, 2 inches shorter than his height, which is usually like a horrible indicator for NBA success, especially on the defensive end. And that's the most surprising part. Like, everybody knew he could get buckets. Like, I mean, I don't think I ever thought he would score 31 points in a playoff game against the one seed. But for him to kind of turn into this like low-key defensive stopper who was, you know, credited with slowing down Steph Curry in the play-in game and, you know, doing a really good job on the Jazz backcourt in game one, like that to me is the most surprising thing. Like I think we all knew he could score, but the fact that he's turned into like a very plus defender at this point is shocking to me.
It really is. I was not expecting it, but and Jaren Jackson hasn't even had like, he's been good in some ways, bad in others. He's very like his stock is very up and down right now, right? But if he can find some sort of stability, I don't think Memphis is going to pull the upset. But their momentum is crazy fast right now, and the Jazz are already on their heels.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up Jaren Jackson because he was a glaring negative for Memphis, I thought, in this game as well as in the play-in game that they won against Golden State. I mean, he's a minus 19 in 24 minutes of this game. And he was benched, I think, like early in the third quarter against Golden State in the play-in for Xavier Tillman. And Tillman played virtually the rest of the way. Like Jackson did not play in the fourth quarter or in overtime of that game. And credit to him, he was up cheering, you know, didn't seem to bother him whatsoever. But I mean, it's not the most encouraging development. I'm more than willing to just chalk it up to a guy that missed like almost the entire regular season, you know, while recovering from that meniscus tear. Like, I don't know what went on with that rehab that took like way longer than your typical meniscus tear. Like I thought he would miss like the first 2 weeks of the season, not the first 4 months. So there's a chance that it's just rust that he needs to shake off. But I mean, he's somebody like we're going to be doing a, you know, kind of an early, way too early, I should say, top 150 for fantasy next year. I have absolutely no idea where to rank Jaren Jackson because, you know, not only are there, you know, mounting injury concerns, you know, now it's like he really doesn't really look like himself since coming back. And even before that, he was just such a weird player to project, you know, this like high scoring, high volume 3-point shooter who also blocks shots, but doesn't rebound whatsoever. And, you know, doesn't really pass. Like he almost had like a Brook Lopez type of stat profile.
He does. Yeah. It is a little similar to that. And I think, I mean, he's been pretty good defensively at least. I mean, he still commits a lot of fouls, but since he's returned 14 games, 1.6 steals, 1.1 blocks in 23 minutes, he had 3 steals and 1 block in this game, but the shot hasn't really been there. I mean, it's 29% from 3 since returning. Part of the problem is his shot form is so bizarre that when it doesn't go in, you're like, of course. He's an interesting player. I like him long-term. I think he's going to have a good career, but there are definitely some parts of his game, like the fouls, especially that he needs to kind of iron out.
All right. So like I said, I don't want to go too hard on, Clippers, Mavs, or Lakers, Suns, just because we're probably going to feel very differently about these series in a matter of hours. But how do you see these playing out? Like, obviously, we'll put this on the record for posterity because most people will be listening to this, you know, after these game twos are played. But let's start with Lakers, Suns. Like, how do you feel about game two if you're the Lakers? It feels like such an obvious bounce back spot for Anthony Davis. I think he has to bounce back by default. I think he played. I was on the record talking to no one, just to myself watching the game. I thought that was the worst that I think I've ever seen him play in game one. You know, the amount of passivity, the lack of urgency, just the general weakness, I guess, going up against DeAndre Ayton, like getting beat for offensive rebound after offensive rebound, not contesting shots at the rim, settling for bad shots. It's hard to imagine Davis plays like that again. My bigger concern for the Lakers is, you know, does LeBron still have the ability to just, you know, throw the team on his back and do like a 38 point, 12 assist, 13 rebound game if they need him to, you know, to avoid an 0-2 hole? Because the LeBron we saw in game one is not all that different from a lot of the game one LeBron performances where he eases into these series, feels things out, usually doesn't take a ton of shots, does a lot of facilitating. But I thought he looked a little heavy. I don't think he seemed all that interested in taking advantage of matchups against guys like Jay Crowder or McCall Bridges, you know, getting to the rim. Settled for a lot of jumpers. I don't know. The lack of urgency for the Lakers, it seems like they're still in this mode of like, hey, we're the champs. We're just, you know, we can turn it on. We're going to beat anybody when we want. I think they've earned the right to act that way and play that way. But you have to realize that, you know, the 2-seed Phoenix Suns are not last year's play-in winner Portland Trailblazers. Like, I don't know if you can get away with that for too much longer.
I agree. LeBron, since he's been back or since he made his initial return, he does seem like a guy who's playing injured. Like it's a lot of standing around on the perimeter. Even when he's posting up, it's not that physical. Like he just goes to the turnaround fade. And this is something like you notice more. Like if you've tried to play a basketball hurt before, even like pickup, you're just like, I'm just going to kind of hang out. Yeah. It feels like LeBron is doing that. And to me, this isn't a must win for the Lakers, but it's close to that. They need to at least come out with some energy. Him, LeBron and Anthony Davis. Because if they're sluggish again, game two, they get beat, it's going to be tough. It really is. I just, it's hard to imagine, you know, the Suns dropping like the Suns dropping four games after that, after the going up
right.
2-0. Like they're too, like you just said, they're too good for that.
Yeah, for me, it's almost less about the Lakers and more about the Suns being a really good team. Like you just can't get away with throwing away two or three games in a series against a team of this caliber. You can do it against the Blazers of last year. You can do it against last year's Rockets and just, you know, calmly win the next four and it's no big deal. But I mean, this is a finals caliber team, I think, in the Phoenix Suns. And if they get past the Lakers, they're going to have a pretty nice path to potentially represent the West in that series. Like I think the Lakers need to respect the opponent. And I don't think they did that in game one. And I think what's frustrating too for the Lakers is they played horrifically. I mean, I think that was like a D plus C minus performance for the Lakers overall. And they still had a chance to win that game. Like multiple times the Suns just kind of went on these runs where they couldn't score. They only got to 99 points in a game that it felt like they dominated from start to finish. So like even after all that, like there was a point where I thought the Lakers were actually going to win this game, and you know they just could not hit shots. So it to me there's a lot of points to look at, but you know the shooting is the number one thing. And I tweeted this out during the game. Like there's a lot of complaining about Andre Drummond, you know, playing at all or playing over Marc Gasol, and obviously Anthony Davis took a lot of heat for the way he played. But I think the Lakers' biggest issue, and to their credit, they had the same problem last year and were able to overcome it. But their biggest problem is their quote-unquote like shooting specialist guys are not good shooters. Like Wes Matthews, 0 of 3 in this game. KCP, 1 of 7. You know, Dennis Schroeder, not exactly a shooting specialist, but he only takes 2 attempts, 1 of 2. Kyle Kuzma, 0 of 1. Alex Caruso, 2 of 4. One of those came in garbage time. Like they need like a Bryn Forbes type, a guy who can just run out there for probably not as long as the Bucks kept Forbes out last night, but you know, the Kyle Korver, the Channing Frye, guys like that LeBron has had, that when they're on the court, he's going to find them and they're going to get good looks, and more often than not, they're going to knock them down. Like they just don't have anybody who can knock down an open three, you know, 70% of the time when it's wide open on the wing, or where it feels like most other really good teams in the league have one or two of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, they are not, I mean, they made the sixth fewest threes in the NBA per game this season, 11.1. It's a pretty low number in the modern NBA. Like top of the league was Jazz at 17. You know, nobody in the top five is under 14. To me, it feels like both of these teams are due for a better game. Like the shooting was just
right.
The Lakers shot 43-27-61, and the Suns shot 47-32-83. So like, both of these teams should be able to cross, like it just based on regression, right? Or progression, mm-hmm. or however you want to put it. Like this next game should end up like 115-112 or something. But
yeah,
the Lakers, yeah, they don't have, like you mentioned, I mean, like I probably have more faith in KCP than most people, but like there's not too many guys on the Lakers who, yeah, you kick out to them in the corner and it's like, you're like, as an opposing fan, you're like already rolling your eyes. You're like, this guy's open.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, KCP, like as someone who watched this game from start to finish, I could assure you that all seven of KCP's looks were wide open. And a few of those were like big time, like, okay, if he makes this, it's a 5-point game. You know, we're right back in it. And they were just back-breaking bricks every single time. And like I don't know what the answer is. They don't have a Bryn Forbes who are like, let's try this guy. You know, it's like, I guess for them, that's Ben McLemore and Jared Dudley. I don't know. I mean, maybe they dust off Markieff Morris. Who knows? But yeah, I think, and you made the point that I was going to bring up, which is, you know, the Lakers, I think, are due for better shooting. They're 7 of 26 as a team from three, but so are the Suns. Like, it felt like the Suns were knocking down shots, but, you know, they're only 9 of 28 from three in that game one. And Jay Crowder, 0 of 7. All of his looks were really good. Mikal Bridges hit a couple of big shots, but he was only 2 of 5 from three. Devin Booker, 3 of 7. I mean, like all those guys are capable of shooting better than that. And I would imagine that even if Chris Paul's not at 100%, I don't really know a whole lot about what a stinger is. I feel like that's like something you hear in football. Honestly, I have no idea what's going on with that. But by all accounts, he's going to play and he's going to be pretty healthy. Like, I think you're probably going to get a better Chris Paul game tonight in game two than you did in game one by virtue of him playing like clearly hobbled for much of that second half. Like, he was like borderline couldn't even dribble with his right hand. Yeah, I don't expect him to be vintage Chris Paul tonight, but he's probably going to look a lot better than he did in the second half of game one.
Yeah, I mean, you get 7 points and 8 assists. It's really the 7 points out of Chris Paul that you know, if you can win against the Lakers and get 7 points out of him, that's great. Yeah, I mean, if he's 100%, yeah, the Lakers are in trouble. Like, it's just the energy has been the main problem. You know, LeBron not looking healthy, just having like no interest in being aggressive offensively. Anthony Davis continuing to like rely on contested mid-range jumpers as his primary form of offense. It's just like infuriating. It's like, yeah. It's, you know, in the bubble that worked. But again, we talked about like in the bubble, a lot of stuff worked for the Heat. That's just not working right now.
Yep.
And like, maybe it does come down to they're super tired. I'm sure if they get destroyed in this round that there's going to be a bunch of pieces coming out. You know, the trainer yeah. said these guys, you know, shouldn't have been playing basketball at all. They need another two. Remember when LeBron's like, I'm not playing until Christmas or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's stuff like that. And it might be true. Right. But we don't know. Yeah.
No, you're 100% right. I have no idea what's going to happen in game two, let alone the rest of the series. But the one prediction I will make is that if the Lakers lose game two and if they're down 0-3 or 3-1 at some point in the series, yeah, there's going to be a full-on rollout in the LA Times of the excuses, I think, that are going to be at the ready. And something that worries me with this Lakers team, too, is like if they lose game two, obviously you're going back home. That provides some energy. This team just doesn't. Yeah, maybe it's because, you know, they won it last year and it's just been such a weird 2 years. There's just no urgency with that. Like, it's hard for me to be like, to look at this Lakers team and be like, oh, these guys, they won't let themselves lose this series. It's like, I feel like they would totally let themselves lose this series. I don't know that they would even really care all that much if they, you know, if their season ended a little bit early and they could just kind of pack it in and come back next year.
They have more built-in excuses than any team in the playoffs.
Yeah. So and they're not afraid to use them. LeBron James is not going to be afraid to roll those out.
That is very true.
The one series we haven't really talked about is Knicks-Hawks, which the main takeaway for me in game one was just how awesome that atmosphere was. Like, that was the best atmosphere in any game in the last year and a half by like a million. Like, there nothing was even close. I can't even think of what would be number two.
No, I don't have a response for that. But like, I was really interested in the series. I think it will be really good the whole way. I think the Hawks will end up winning, but I wouldn't be shocked by the Knicks winning. I just love this because it's a team who makes their living on defense and just pure like grit.
Yep.
Against a team that is like extremely modern, fires a ton of threes, has a point guard that just like it just can't play defense. Bug is insane. Like, Trae Young, 32-10 with two turnovers in his playoff debut against one of the best defensive teams in the league in New York with the fans back. It's like, it's cold-blooded.
Only took three threes, too.
I know, and that's something we talked about earlier on this podcast. It's just like, he's way better at, like, he's taking fewer threes this year, but I think he's just a better player.
Yeah,
and the weapons around him, like, he's so good at making the weapons around him just pop. But they didn't even get a great game out of it. Like, DeAndre Hunter was basically a non-factor in his 22 minutes, at least offensively. John Collins, only 12 points. Gallinari went 3-for-11. You know, I know there's stuff on the Knicks side, too. Like, Julius Randle's not probably going to go 6-for-23 again. I mean, that was legitimately awful.
That was bad.
But on the other hand, they're not getting 27 points from Alec Burks again. You know, like, it's there's a lot of stuff in the series that I think is going to be fun to watch. It's such a fun series.
Yeah, it was a very strange game one where you have, you know, the star on one team playing, you know, one of his most memorable games of his career. I mean, he was 3 rebounds away from a triple double in his first playoff game. I thought Bogdanovich was really good for them. Unsurprisingly, he hit some huge shots down the stretch, a couple big 3-pointers. And then Lou Williams in his 13 minutes, like he had a really nice run at, I think it was in the third quarter, maybe even early fourth, where he came in. And just when it seemed like the Knicks were starting to establish an advantage and probably not run away with it, but at least, you know, feel good about where they were down the stretch. You know, he came in, gave them like 7 quick points and all of a sudden it was, you know, right back to even. Those three guys were huge. But like you said, other than that, it you know, it wasn't like a dominant performance by Atlanta by any means. And then on the other side, New York, I mean, Julius Randle has a bottom three game for him all season, which, you know, still at a double-double. That speaks more to just how good he's been all year. But they got almost nothing out of the starting lineup. You know, RJ Barrett, 1 of 6 from three. He had one miss that would have just absolutely taken the top off the building, a wide open corner three that would have put the Knicks up, I think, like 9 or 10.
And once that rimmed out, it felt like the door was kind of back open for Atlanta. But the Knicks bench was insane in this game. Like one of the best bench performances that you're going to see really from any team this season. Like 17 for Derrick Rose. Like you mentioned, Alec Burks, like that was probably the most memorable game of his career by a mile. Emmanuel Quickley, had some huge shots in this game. He was 2 of 2 from three. So just a really, really strange game where, the one guy that New York has been able to depend on game in, game out every single night. And he was just announced as the most improved player winner, by the way, which was shocking to no one. But Randle having that game and the Knicks still being in position to win is kind of crazy how it turned out. But I still feel like this could go 6 or 7. I hope it does. I just want as many games as possible in Madison Square Garden. So I will be pulling for the Knicks just so we get to see Knicks Sixers and, Joel Embiid coming into the Garden for at least 2 games in round 2.
I think part of like something that's going underrated about this game is just like the lack of free throws, which is enjoyable.
Yeah. Like, it was a very fast game.
Yeah. When a game gets bogged down by free throws, it's just awful. Like I'm not opposed to slow paced basketball, which this was. It's just when it's slow paced and there's a ton of fouls, it's just like, it feels like a chore to watch. The team shot a combined 23 free throws in this game. And Trae Young had 9 of the Hawks 12. So like kind of surprising given like, especially the physical nature of the Knicks, but yeah, just a really enjoyable watch. I hope it keeps also a low turnover game, 17 combined turnovers for the team. So I hope the series stays like this. Cause it's just like, it's fun basketball to watch. The atmosphere is great. It's just a really compelling series right now.
All right, let's end on this. For posterity, give me your picks for tonight's games. We'll revisit these later in the week on the next pod. So we got Celtics at Nets, Lakers at Suns, Mavs at Clippers.
So I'm going Nets, Lakers, Clippers. But I actually have the least confidence in the Lakers, believe it or not. But for our betting article, I took Lakers Clippers parlay for both to win. I think it was plus 130. I just think it's like must win for both of them.
Well, who's it a bigger must win for? I think it has to be the Clippers, right? Just because even if the Lakers, like zooming out and just taking everything in totality, like Anthony Davis and LeBron are locked in, at least we think. The Clippers obviously have a lot on the line as far as like what the future roster looks like. But at the end of the day, the Lakers can always fall back on, hey, we won the title last year. Like, it's kind of a trump card, whereas they could get swept by the Suns and it would be embarrassing and there'd be a lot of questions. But, they could always just be like, we just won the title last year. You really can't say all that much. Whereas the Clippers have no history whatsoever to fall back on.
I know that Paul George and Kawhi Leonard are both like also sort of hurt, like Anthony Davis and LeBron are, but it kind of just feels like they have no excuses at this point, right? Like the super team thing, their roster is better than last year without question. If they get smoked again by Doncic, they're in trouble.
They are. I think you said the Lakers are the team you have the least confidence in. I think that's right. I feel the same way, but I also think, the spread for that Lakers or Clippers Mavs game was up to like 7.5 or maybe even 8 earlier today. Like I don't think like there's a whole lot that suggests the Clippers are just going to come back and blow them out. Like I would pick the Clippers to win tonight, but I think the Mavs, like when you have a guy like Luka who just controls everything and can completely dictate the pace of an entire game, it'll probably be out there for 42 minutes. Like I think the Mavs will at least be able to keep this really close.
Yeah, I was fine with like the Clippers, like a bet for them to win, but like the spread, 7 or 7.5 based on where you look, did not like it. Little, it's too wide.
Yeah, a little bit of a lack of respect for the Mavs, who I think have played the Clippers really well. And I mean, even going back to last year, regular season, Kristaps Porzingis missed the latter half of that series last year, and they were still able to really make the Clippers work for that. And I wouldn't be surprised if Dallas internally, really feels like they are the better team in this series, even though they were also kind of trying to dodge the Clippers in round one, over that final week of the regular season. Like I don't think any team wants to go up against, wing defenders in George and Kawhi, but I don't know. The way that Dallas came out in game one, like, I don't think he, has any doubt that they're able to win the series.
I agree. I mean, Luka Doncic is, his playoff career numbers are already ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it very much passes the eye test too, right? But like seven playoff games, he's 31-10-9 on 49% shooting.
Yeah.
As a 22-year-old right now. I mean, it's
right.
I don't know how you stop him. I just, no one, I mean, the only, granted, the only team he's ever played in the playoffs is the Clippers, but they have no answer for him.
Yeah, it's like usually when you look back at like career stats, like if you throw out the first 2 years and like the last 2 years, you get a better sample. But it's like, is Doncic just going to get better, or is like is he going to go down from here? Like usually guys are, you know, or like most guys in their first playoffs, like 70-80% of those guys are like bench players or they're getting DMPs. Like if you're starting out at 31-10-9, like where do you go from there?
I don't know, and the team around him isn't even that good.
Yeah. Absolutely crazy. And they might not have Kleba tonight. If they don't have Kleba, I think the Clippers are able to win fairly handily. I still think it'll be, you know, reasonably close, but not having him to throw on one of those guys, especially Kawhi, for 30 plus minutes would be huge.
Yeah, the line kind of makes it seem like the books have a strong, they might know Kleba's out.
Yeah.
Or very much less than 100%.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. All right, I'll go Nets. I'm going to take the Suns at home. Betting against LeBron at my own peril, but I think there's a, you know, a physical health element to LeBron losing game one and needing to bounce back that has not really been a part of, you know, these last few situations where the Lakers or the Cavs or whoever it's been have found themselves down 0-1. Like has there been another time where, you know, there's been any kind of serious health question with LeBron in the playoffs?
Well, he did break his hand.
He did break his hand.
We didn't find out that till afterward, right?
Yeah. Yes, that is true. He did break his hand. That was one of the times they were down 0-1. But no, I just feel like if there were no health questions and LeBron looked like he did in January, no question about it. You know, I don't think there's any panic. I think the Lakers bounce back. But with that being the caveat, I still have some trepidation. And I think Phoenix, you know, believes they can win the series, much like I think Dallas believes they can beat the Clippers. So I'll go Brooklyn handily, Phoenix in a close one. And I'm with you. I think the Clippers do take care of business, but I think Dallas covers tonight.